Let me just pray for a moment. Lord, though we may have heard these words before, may we hear them today as though for the first time. May your Spirit move this morning and bring us understanding and revelation. Amen. There are times in life when you need to know that someone will come to help. Someone will come to help you. If you call out for help, if you're in trouble, you need to know that somebody's going to come to your rescue. Now, having been on holiday in Northumberland by the sea, we've walked past recently quite a few lifeboat stations, and it reminds you what a crucial job those lifeboat men and women do. You know by now that I have a few secret pleasures in life. One of them was DIY SOS. The other one is saving lives at sea. So I couldn't resist the temptation to play a little clip from Saving Lives at Sea.
Bringing gale force winds, raging seas, and an urgent call to the Coast Guard.
Usually when the pager goes off in those conditions, something has probably gone very wrong and somebody is really in trouble.
The call has come in from the wife of a windsurfer in distress.
The situation is there's a reported windsurfer in difficulty at Gullen. Don't have a good description of him other than his windsurfer.
That did get worse as we approached the casualty. The position that they were in around small cliffs and a rocky bay. That's where the wind is driving the waves.
No, I go faster!
It wasn't too far off the shore. However, the direction of the wind and the magnitude of the waves meant that there was no way he could swim towards the shore.
The crew head into the shallows, aware that both the casualty and the boat are running out of time.
Get out of them, quick!
You don't want to mess about.
Go, go, go!
You pull them into the boat as fast as you possibly can. And then you get out of that situation as fast as you possibly can.
The casualty was quite shocked. He was very subdued when we got him on board.
Are you okay? You're not
He had a good wetsuit on. However, anyone in those conditions, no matter how good their kit, is going to be cold.
I expect that guy was very grateful to be rescued by those lifeboatmen. How many people would say, why do I need to call out to God, to a God that I'm not sure about anyway? Why, I don't need rescuing, thank you very much. My life's okay. And our lives can seem quite comfortable, can't they? We can tell ourselves that, you know, I can manage on my own. I can figure things out for myself. The thing is, we don't always have the right perspective in life. A number of years ago, I was spending a few days on Lindisfarne, Holy Island. I decided to walk the Pilgrim Way. Some of you may well have done it. You follow a series of beacons across the sand at low tide. And I set out on this thinking that the sand looked firm and easy to walk on. How wrong I was. Halfway across, it became clear there were all sorts of terrain that I had to walk on. And the sand became very wet, and my feet at times began to sink into the sand. It felt a little bit like you were on sort of quicksand at times. It was very disconcerting and more than a little frightening as the wind howled. That sense of not being on ground as firm as I'd expected. Sometimes in life, what we imagine to be firm ground that we're standing on isn't. And for me, in my life, doubt about my code for living crept in as I read about the life of Jesus and as I compared my life to the way that he lived his life. An old lady once told her vicar appreciatively, "Vicar, we didn't know what sin was until you came to the parish." I didn't really know what sin was until I saw Jesus modeling a life that was pleasing to God. And I thought I was a, you know, reasonably okay, good guy, fairly moral, pretty respectful most of the time. But you know that feeling when you look upon freshly fallen snow and the pure brilliance of the white of that snow shows you that most other shades of white that we encounter in life are fairly dirty in comparison. The writer G.K. Chesterton once commented on the morality of the philosopher Bertrand Russell. He said this: he treated the Ten Commandments like one of those exam papers which have at the top, not more than six of these should be attempted. And that's how many of us go through life, thinking we can choose that bit, that commandment. Well, I'm not too bad on that one. Don't really know about that one. Don't need to bother about that one. The Bible is quite clear, and it's quite clear in this passage from Romans, that Jesus Christ is the key to our being put right with God and to knowing him fully. He's the one who can help repair our broken relationship with God. See, the dilemma that faces all of us is this: how can we come into the presence of a holy God who is pure and faultless when the painful fact is that most of us find it impossible to live in this way? We're in need of forgiveness. We can't make ourselves righteous in God's eyes. Paul diagnoses the problem in this letter to the Romans. He talks in the first bit of that chapter about how the Jewish people are very zealous for God. But he talks about them refusing to accept God's way. They cling to their own way of getting right with God by trying to keep the law. The popular view around is still that if you try to do good and if you try not to harm anybody, it puts you on good terms with God. We prefer to live by what we might call the ladder of achievement. In other words, God rewards us for our good behavior. And being proud of our ability to pay our way in life, we think that we can come up to the mark. In the exam of life, we're pretty sure that we're going to be in the A grade. But the trouble is that God's standards are perfection. And the hard truth is that none of us ever succeed in keeping the law perfectly. In Romans 10, Paul is proclaiming a simple truth: that nobody, by their own efforts, is good enough for God. God's not impressed by our carefully crafted CVs, our efforts to establish our credentials, to promote ourselves as good people. Doesn't cut the mustard. Paul outlines a way for us to come to a knowledge that we are fully accepted, that we are forgiven, that we are welcomed by God into his restored community. And it's deceptively simple. And remarkably, it's got nothing at all to do with keeping rules. Verse 9, if you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. So this isn't about a kind of vague awareness, a general sense of there being a higher power in life. It's not about an intellectual or a philosophical interest in Christianity as an academic subject. There is something to say and there is something to believe. We have to use our lips to acknowledge that Jesus is Lord. Now, in the ancient world, Lord was a title for Caesar, the Roman Emperor. So saying that Jesus is Lord meant that Caesar wasn't Lord. And politically, that could get you into a whole heap of trouble. Lord means one who has authority over us, a master who deserves respect. Jesus is Lord over the whole universe. And the Gospels show us this: Jesus has power over nature, over sickness, over sin, and over death. And because Jesus won for us by God and by the cross and resurrection, our salvation, we belong to him. We owe him a debt. He's the boss. He's the master. He's our supreme divine ruler. And to him, we owe our foremost allegiance. So there's something we have to say, and then there's something we have to believe, that God raised Jesus from death. For Paul, Jesus' resurrection was the demonstration that this guy really was the Messiah. This is the turning point of the whole of human history. God wants us to be prepared to acknowledge that Jesus was and is the Messiah, God's own Son. If we want to have a true Christian faith, then we need to believe certain things about the person of Jesus Christ, that he came from God, that he spoke and acted as God, that he was crucified for our sin and raised from the dead. And we need to be convicted of the fact that Jesus shares the very nature of God, his authority, his power, his holiness. And we also need to believe and put our faith in the pardon that Jesus offers. We have to believe that by his death on the cross, Jesus has done everything necessary for our salvation. Now that word confession means to agree with, to declare, to speak out openly what you believe. It's really about the mouth giving voice to what the heart believes. Acknowledging, believing. Paul is saying this is the gateway to knowing that you are in a saving relationship with God. When I was a curate, I had the privilege of explaining this very verse to a young mum. She'd been attending an inquirers group that I'd been running in the local pub. And she became a Christian there and then. At my leaving service, at the end of my curacy, her husband stood up to say that he'd decided to follow Jesus too. In fact, out of the 13 people who had attended that inquirer's course in that pub, all of them became Christians. I've never seen anything like it since in this country. Our passage tells us that God richly blesses all who call on him. There's no partiality. It applies to everybody. All human differences between people are rendered unimportant. All distinctions of wealth, of status, of title, nationality, they mean nothing. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Now, if God is offering us such a precious gift, a way of being put right with him, then why don't we leap at the offer? God feels sadness as he looks upon us. He experiences the pain of unrequited love. Isaiah 65, he says, to a nation that did not call on my name, I said, here I am, all day long I've held out my hands to an obstinate people. All day long, I held out my hands. Well, maybe it's because we find charity hard to accept. We'd rather work for things. We certainly find it hard to admit any sense of need. It's interesting, they say that you can't help a drowning man until he stops struggling. It took me 3 years to stop struggling with God and to receive his gift of salvation. It was hard to humble myself, to accept I needed something that was totally undeserved. Sometimes we can think that believing in Jesus is like taking a massive leap into the dark, into the unknown. I can only say that as you jump into the darkness, you find that the darkness is actually light. Verse 11, whoever believes in him will not be disappointed. We often say in life, seeing is believing. But for the Christian, seeing comes more fully as we believe, as we put our trust in God. To believe in Jesus doesn't mean that you have to have all the answers to all your questions sorted and wrapped up. You can take that first step and then you can spend a lifetime making sense of your remaining questions. A minister was preaching in the chapel of a psychiatric hospital. In the middle of his sermon, one of the patients stood up and shouted, "How long have we got to listen to this appalling rubbish?" The minister turned to the consultant psychiatrist next to him and whispered rather nervously, "Oh, shall I stop speaking?" "No, no, go ahead," said the psychiatrist. "But what if he interrupts again?" said the minister, not wanting to cause a scene. "No, he won't, I can assure you," said the psychiatrist. "That man has only had one lucid moment in 7 years." I hope that you have had a lucid moment during the course of this sermon. I heard a number of sermons and talks in my life before I became a Christian. There was only one moment when I heard things in a totally different way with absolute clarity. And God said, "You know, this is true." May today be that moment for somebody here this morning. Everyone who calls out to the Lord will be saved. You may be waiting for 100% proof. Let me say, we'll never find 100% proof for anything in life. It always comes down to a balance of probabilities. The Jesuit writer Henri Nouwen became fascinated by the work of trapeze artists, by the idea of flying through the air, letting go, and having to trust that there was another acrobat who would catch you. It seemed dangerous, but everything depends on the skill, the dedication of the catcher. Let's have a look at what that might feel like.
Anybody can fly to your hands. The first couple of weeks, it was scary. When you're a flyer and you become a catcher, it's hard because you're seeing that body coming at you. It's like a fight. Every part of your body has got to be stiff. You got to grab that wrist, and then you got to let him down. Like somebody will attach 140 pounds to your wrist, and they just drop it.
If you leap, there is one who's going to catch you. It's never easy to leap into space, but we can trust that God is the one who is waiting to catch us. And when we exercise faith, there is no one better to catch us. So maybe this trapeze artist is not a bad metaphor or image for what is necessary to enter into relationship with God. But as I finish, let me say, faith is not just a flash in the pan when we need it. Faith is a lifetime of following. It's not a one-time confession. We need to recognize Jesus afresh as Lord every day of our lives. Faith in Jesus for us has to be about believing, going on believing to the end of our lives. It needs to be a continuing faith, because Jesus is going to be looking for evidence of our confession in our lives. Let's pause there and just leave a moment of silence. What is it God has been saying to you this morning? The song we're going to sing in response to the things I've been saying is an invitation to come and follow Jesus.